You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tere rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producers Arno and Nicholas. As part of 95BFM's election coverage, this week on The Wire, we are focusing on the local economy. Whai Ahine coming up on the show, I speak to New Zealand Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff, Child Poverty Action Group's Alan Johnson, economist Brad Olson, and senior taxation lecturer at Auckland University of Technology, Ranjana Gupta, about different policies aimed at addressing the cost of living crisis. Millie speaks to the co-director of the Public Health Communications Centre and professor in public health at the University of Otago, Nick Wilson, about new research which found that political parties tend to be short-sighted in their policies when it comes to global catastrophic risks. And Marty chats to biologist and winner of the University of Auckland 3-minute thesis competition, Cam Hofbleck, about her new research into the unique gut microbiome of Tuatara. Arno, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez-March about wealth inequality, the Greens' economic policies, and a proposed wealth tax to provide free universal dental care.
Nicholas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke with the New Zealand Students Association National President Alan Dixon about what a universal study wage would look like and the potential economic realities surrounding its implementation.
He aha ufakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anō he pakihere roki roki mā runga i te pai tuku tuku. O Irirangi Poho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com, and you can catch all of our stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Wealth inequality, ending poverty, and the cost of living crisis are pressing issues this upcoming election. The Green Party are the only party supporting a wealth tax and a universal basic income. I spoke with Green MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the Green Party's economic policies and their reasoning behind them. I started off our interview by asking how the Greens' tax plan differs from others.
Well, the Green Party is proposing is effectively a tax switch, where we are planning to introduce a wealth tax for the richest few families, but at the same time introduce a tax-free threshold, which would mean 95% of people in Aotearoa will be better off. And this differs from the Labour Party, who's not really wanting to offer anything on tax, and the National Enact Party, who are offering tax cuts, who will disproportionately benefit the wealthiest few.
Some parties have promised tax cuts for groups like landlords and business owners, as you mentioned, but the Green Party has not. Why is this?
Because the evidence and the research shows that actually ordinary people pay a highest tax rate than those who are wealthiest. And Aotearoa is an outlier, and that we're one of the few developed countries that does not have a capital gains tax, a wealth tax, or a similar tax to target those who are the wealthiest to be able to fund things like decent healthcare, public housing, and good incomes for groups like students.
How does the wealth inequality we have in New Zealand materially impact Kiwis?
So the impact of wealth inequality looks like a small group of people owning a huge amount of houses, which means they're able to then drive things like rents, and this this is part of the reason we've also ended up with really high rents. And less people being homeowners or having access to secure public housing in the long term. And so while the National Enact Party may allude to or may suggest that wealth trickles down from the few wealthiest to the rest of society, what we have seen is actually more people holding less of the wealth, while a very, very few number of people actually holding a disproportionate amount of wealth over time.
Labor has ruled out a wealth tax. What does this mean for your relationship with the Labor Party going into the election?
Well, what I will begin saying is Chris Hipkins of the Labor Party actually cannot rule out any of these policies. It's up to the voters. And if the voters like a wealth tax, free dental care, and income guarantee for students, voting for the Greens puts it on the government agenda. Because ultimately, all parties who are forming government will need to sit together to negotiate, and our negotiating hand is determined by the proportion of votes that we get after the election. Our relationship with Labor has not changed, and that we have always had clear policy differences, and we've always been able to disagree with the Labor Party on areas where there is no common ground. And right now, the Labor Party is campaigning to retain the status quo when it comes to wealth inequality, and the Greens aren't, being the only party in Parliament offering to fix it.
Moving on to dental, the Green Party has advocated for free dental care for all. According to a recent One News poll, 63% of Kiwis want a wealth tax if it meant everyone could access free dental care. Why do you think this isn't translating into higher polling for the Green Party as a whole?
Well, we are rising in the polls, and recent polls do have us rising some to 12%. And so we are on track to potentially have our biggest result ever. But we also don't take these polls for granted, and ultimately this is about us campaigning on the ground, having those conversations with our peers about the policies that we're offering and the vision that we have for Aotearoa. So while it is really encouraging to see that a great majority of people support free dental care paid for by a wealth tax, which is the question in the poll, we know that we will have to continue campaigning hard to grow our vote and to create an Aotearoa where this becomes a reality.
Can you tell us a bit about the clean power payment the Green Party is proposing?
Yes, so what we've said is that basically we want to ensure that people are able to have homes that are energy efficient and that can reduce emissions. And many of our homes, like things like heat pumps, double glazing, or solar panels, for example, things like lacking heat pumps and double glazing has a huge impact on someone's ability to have a home that is warm and dry and that doesn't therefore use a lot of energy to keep it warm. So what we've offered is a $6,000 grant, and this is fully costed as part of our tax reform. And this will enable people to basically have better insulation or potentially replace fossil fuel appliances like gas heaters with cleaner alternatives. So, and we've also said that we can offer a $30,000 interest-free loan to cover any other additional upgrades.
Moving on to some of your other policies, how will students fare under the Greens' proposed pledge to renters, a policy which includes rent control?
Yeah, so for students, the things that we're offering is both rent controls, but also most importantly, an income guarantee, which effectively will provide income support for all students universally and higher than the current universal student allowance rate. So it's a baseline of 385. But we know that because a lot of students rent, what we've proposed is capping the amount that rents can go by so that incomes actually go up faster than the cost of rents. And so we'll adjust and limit rent increases to wage growth or inflation to ensure that incomes rise faster than those two. And this is because we know that rents have risen over time a lot faster than incomes, and that for a lot of students, over half of their income can end up going into trying to pay rent, meaning students end up working multiple jobs to try and just survive during their studies. And that affects someone's ability to actually finish their studies as well.
Finally, can you briefly explain proposals for universal basic income? What would this involve and how would it help Kiwis?
So the Green Party is proposing an income guarantee, which will provide a payment for everyone who is studying, caring, or not in full-time employment. This will be around $385, and then there will be additional top-ups for parents and disabled people. And what we want to do is simplify the income support system, lift every family out of poverty, but also end the discriminatory approach for students where many are unable to access student loans through the course of their degree. So for students, this will mean a certainty that you'll have income support throughout your degree. And we think this is essential if we want to end the inequities in our education system and support students to complete their studies.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez on the Green Party's economic policies ahead of the election, including wealth tax and universal basic income.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged. The Wire.
Research from Alliance has shown that young people are feeling the worst effects of the cost of living crisis. Many of those worst affected by the rising level costs are students. Recently, there's been a push to implement a universal study wage, spearheaded by the student associations of Otago and Victoria Universities, with support from the National Students Associations Union. I spoke with the New Zealand Union of Students Associations National President, Alan Dixon, about the potential cost of a study wage, as well as its potential benefits and the political support for it so far.
Oh, there's so many things that I could say that are currently wrong with the student support scheme, and I think $16 billion in student debt is probably the first place that I can start off, which very much articulates the problem that we're dealing with at the moment, and the fact that two-thirds of students are currently living in poverty demonstrates that it is not working.
I wanted to ask as well what the NZUSA's current proposal is for a change in the scheme, and how a universal student income would work.
Yeah, so currently as a part of our general elections campaign, which is called No More Excuses, you can find it at www.nomoreexcuses.online. One of our policy areas that we put forward is a debt-free future. This was negotiated between the students' associations across the Motu, which is really, really cool, and it focuses specifically on a number of different areas in connection to not just student debt, but actually putting forward a sustainable process of having affordability in education for students. So it has three particular areas we're asking for, which is implementing a study wage for all, a free and accessible education, so prioritising education as a human right and a social good rather than as a marketised model, and forgiveness of student debt and debt repayment plans, or like complete debt forgiveness, just moving towards sort of a kōrero within that space of what is essential in managing debt. So in terms of the universal education income, it's had a little bit of a facelift, with now being called a study wage for all. It's been championed by Otago University Students Association and Victoria University of Wellington Students Association alongside us in that space. The reason it's been called a study wage for all is a lot of people don't know what a universal education income would look like. But what's been proposed with this model is the idea that students can study and be paid financially in a sustainable way so that they do not have to go into poverty in order to study at higher education. So the vision is that $385 approximately a week after tax could be recalculated each year to ensure that students can make ends meet in the space of their study, so that they're not having to take out, because we're seeing, you know, awful things where students are regularly taking out 20-hour to 40-hour working weeks in addition to doing study, which is quite a bit of work for people to deal with. So the concept of the study wage, it takes from overseas. We're looking more towards the Nordic models, which is where there's this internal system that very much values education as building back into the community, a system that we used to have in our country. We used to have bursaries and grants that had a very similar model, and they were taken away by successive governments who kept taking money from students in those spaces and seeing us more as a market and as human capital than as people. So, yeah, we're wanting to reinstate a system that allows for students to feel like they don't have to go out continuously or depend on family in those spaces to be able to get a higher education, to get their qualifications.
I was having a look at your website, and on your website you guys published a report in 2020 and 2021 talking about the actual cost of it. So as part of that cost breakdown, you said that study wage would cost New Zealand just under $3.7 billion a year. Do you have any updated figures on what that would cost for 2023?
Not currently, but there is an estimate, and it's been put forward by one political party, who I'm not sure if it's been done publicly yet, so I won't put them in the deep end on that one. But there is a belief that if we were to relook at the structure of means testing as it currently exists within StudyLink, that the actual amount that we spend on getting people so that they can do the means testing in order to test it, how much of a percentage, I think it's somewhere between 12 and 15% of students who can receive student allowance, could also compare financially, that if we were having some type of study wage for all, that could be a similar financial level of how much is being spent in those spaces. But, you know, that's very dependent on us actually sitting in that space and doing those calculations, ensuring that our politicians are accountable this general election for those calculations and the cost of living crisis, because one of the things that, although we do have this estimate that a study wage for all would be beneficial at $385 per week, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is accounting for inflation. So, it is a complex situation in terms of the cost of living crisis currently, but I think it is a conversation that more political parties should be having in this current climate.
Yeah, and I do want to touch on that. Obviously, we are in an election year. The Greens have already kind of expressed support for a study wage. I want to ask if any other political parties have been in conversation with you guys about the possibility of this or the numbers behind it.
Currently, at this point in time, I do not believe so. Labor has been open to looking at the numbers if we were to propose a move from the means testing across to a study wage. So they've been open to the idea and willing to look at the statistics. The last time we talked to the Minister of Education, we were in that meeting with the coalition who are running the Study Wage for All campaign, and she was open, Minister Tennessee. But that being open is not the same thing as including it in your political party positions. And I also think, you know, given the fact that they're put so much into fees-free as a policy area, and then also the training and apprentices funds that are available at the moment coming off of budget. It's like, I don't understand why this is not more of a priority in this space, especially when it's been one of those like previous election promises, particularly in postgraduate spaces, that has not come forward. So at the moment, we can see a strong commitment from Greens. There has been a little bit of movement in terms of the stuff that TOP is doing. NZ First has had a little bit of interest, particularly in the educational spaces, for supporting like the internal structure of Aotearoa New Zealand. But very few of them are looking at how that impacts the lives of students, other than Greens at this point in time, which is a pity, because I think they're missing the essential voters here, which are young people.
Yeah, do you have a number of, as to how many people in New Zealand are students? Because it must be quite a big voting block that a lot of parties want to, you know, tie in.
Yeah, so the number of tertiary students in Aotearoa New Zealand is approximately always at about 400,000. Which I believe, don't quote me on this one, but I believe it's somewhere between 10 to 15% of voters currently, which is quite a large number when you think about it in comparison with other parts of society. So, you know, they can make a significant impact. I think it was something we were talking with UNICEF Aotearoa recently, and they were saying it only takes something like 30,000 votes in order to get someone into Parliament. Obviously, that's under MMP, it's actually a party-based structure, if you're a list and not specifically focused on a region. But young people have the capacity to be able to vote like that. If they wanted to get particular parties in, they could. If they want to support these types of initiatives and campaigning, they can. They've just had years of systemic pushback from society, which is discouraging them through, you know, things of not being paid appropriately for the work that they're doing in that space, through the gig economy, through things like that, where they've been normalised to not having enough, having to struggle and becoming apathetic politically in some contexts. But I think, given that we have a whole number of young people running currently, for this coming parliament and government that's coming in. I think it's exciting to see that these types of conversations will be more on the table. We've got, you know, Greens and Labor are increasingly running young people. I've seen some recently for NZ First. I've seen some recently for National. So we're going to see these types of conversations shift, I think, the climate that we're in discussions politically on debt and student debt in particular.
And also a part of that, I guess, you guys have a petition on your website as well to get signatures for that. Do you have a number on how many people have signed your petition so far?
So this petition is being led by OUSA and Reducer. So it is something, what's happened within our policy areas that we are focusing on within this space is they are being championed by each of our local students' associations, and this is particularly their area. I can tell you the number of those who have signed the petition. You can sign it on Action Station as well, and we do encourage people to continue doing that. So currently the numbers that it's 1,000, approximately 1,500 signatures, but we want more. So if you just log on to Action Station and search up A Study Wage for All, you will find it. There's a letter to the Minister of Education on that, and you just put your name down as you would on any online campaign in that space, and you can join the movement in order to try and push for support for students for this coming year.
That was the National President of the New Zealand Union of Students Association, Alan Dixon, discussing a universal study wage and the economic implementation and political support for the scheme so far.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We'll be back right after this short break. Keep it on the B.
95BFM has returned to the rave and popped out the cutest little rave baby the station has ever seen. Say hello to the world, B-Rave.
B-Rave, this Friday at the Mothership, presented by Lord of the Fries and 95BFM.
Featuring the hottest lineup of DJs from 6 collectives and labels across Aotearoa. Monogamy, Kieran Tahir, Birkenfart, Karu, Hashi DJ, Left Hand Lars. Expect anything and everything, from the hardest jungle to the weirdest hyperpop.
B-Rave at the Mothership this Friday. Tickets just $15 from Under the Radar.
Shotties, Lord of the Fries, eat like you give a f***.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morena, Mr. Sloth, Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show, bringing stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago.
The 95BFM Kids Show with Lee and Finn, 7 till 9 every Sunday morning. Brought to you by the New Zealand Maritime Museum. Hui te ananui a Tangaroa.
Classic journal question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. In the lead-up to the election, political parties have been proposing different measures to address the cost of living crisis. If re-elected, Labor has promised to scrap goods and services tax from fresh fruit and frozen fruit, as well as fresh and frozen vegetables, from 1st of April next year, claiming it would save an average household about $4.25 a week. First, I spoke to New Zealand Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff and asked him about what impact they believe the policy would have for low to middle income workers and their whānau.
Well, it certainly will help bring down the cost of those food items. It's not really a policy that we think is the best way of taxing people. We think that we should be looking at wealth tax and capital gains tax, but nonetheless, compared to the other parties, the other opposition parties, you know, this will be better for people to put food on the table. The tax cuts that have been proposed by the opposition parties really just go to the wealthy. And I think it's something like $2.15 a week is all a minimum wage worker would get. And tax cuts just mean less sharing of wealth, and that's what the opposition parties are promising.
Next up, I also asked Child Poverty Action Group's Alan Johnson to weigh in on how effective they believe this policy would be, in alleviating cost of living pressures.
Look, it's acknowledged that it was most likely going to benefit families by about $20 a month. So it's not going to significantly change the prices and the costs that they face. So for us, we think it's very much a sort of nominal gesture to the so-called cost of living crisis, and that there's better ways of addressing the poverty that we see amongst, you know, a small minority of families, around 20% perhaps.
We've seen Te Pāti Māori in particular call for this to be extended to all food. Is there anywhere that you see that this policy could be improved?
No, we don't see any value in removing GST from food at all. If we're particularly interested in people being able to afford decent quality food, you can do much better than simply removing GST on food. For example, you can improve the incomes of the people who earn and receive the least income. You can do something around the quality of food that's sold in poorer communities. You can do something around whether or not we have, for example, taxes on sugar and those sorts of things. So there's lots of ways of improving the nutritional standards of New Zealanders without resorting to what we believe are quite ad hoc measures to tinker with the GST system.
And what measures would you like to see specifically targeting low to middle income people and their whānau?
One of the biggest things that we think could make a difference to child poverty is for the government to revise the Working for Families program and do away with a thing called the NWORK tax credit, which is a discriminatory payment paid only to families who are working and not to families on benefits. If we wanted to lift, you know, substantial numbers, and we're talking tens of thousands of children out of poverty, that's the first thing we can do. In addition to that, and in longer term measure, we actually have to do far more to improve the availability of social housing, particularly public rental housing. And so we'd suggest the government needs to have a longer term commitment to building more state houses.
To hear from an economist's perspective, I first spoke to Chief Executive and Principal Economist at Infometrics, Brad Olson, who has been a vocal opponent of the policy. I started off the interview by asking him why he believes the policy would not benefit consumers.
I don't think that removing GST from fresh and frozen fruits and vegetables would actually do much to what people pay themselves at the supermarket. Now, of course, this policy is popular with people. When you say that you're going to take GST off these sort of items, it sounds like that money is going to go back to households. However, that's unlikely to happen. We know that overseas, in the likes of the UK, for example, when they've removed their equivalent of GST off like the likes of period products or books, that actually the cost savings through to households has been only about 20% of the actual tax removed. So it's difficult to administer. You've got to decide what's in, what's out. Washed potatoes, for example, are they still fresh or have they been processed? You've also got the complexities of whether or not this is passed on, given that a lot of the time GST is an indirect tax. And probably most importantly, the likes of removing GST off food doesn't actually target support to those who need it the most. And the big challenge here is that we know that, yes, food is expensive. Higher income households can cope better with those high expenses. Low income households don't cope quite as well. They need more support. But removal of GST would affect everyone equally, which would mean that households that buy a lot more food, higher income households, would get a lot more of the dollar benefit from this policy. So politically popular, economically, probably wouldn't actually do much to your food bill.
And why do you think this policy has been considered politically popular?
The cost of food at the moment has increased at such a great pace that households are looking for any relief that they can find it. Food price inflation in recent times has been at like a 40-year high, the largest since GST was actually introduced back in the late 1980s. So households are feeling it each and every day when they go to the supermarket, just how expensive food is. And so, a policy targeting food is always going to be popular, particularly because people would simplistically expect that removing GST from fresh fruits and vegetables would drop the price. The difficulty is that that's not actually likely to happen. Of course, producers up and down the supply chain know that households are willing to buy an amount for a good. And so if you take GST off, It's not likely that the cost of that good remains at the GST exclusive price for very long. It will likely rise over time as businesses look to capture that amount of money that households are already willing to shell out on food. So it's popular because people expect to get something from it. It's not economically sensible, given that although people expect to get something from it, they probably wouldn't get that money back.
Lastly, I spoke to Senior Taxation Lecturer at the Auckland University of Technology, Ranjana Gupta, about her thoughts on the policy and suggested potential alternatives. Here she is now.
In my opinion, this policy will rather increase the cost indirectly for the taxpayers rather than decreasing the cost. The reason I'm saying that is, yes, on the face, we consumers will like that prices of fruits and vegetables, as said by labor, will decrease. So we will save some money, and that money we can use to buy other products or more fruits and veggies. So that looks good on the face, but the impact of that will be that, first of all, look, whether price will decrease or not depends on whether the sellers will pass this decrease in prices to the consumers. And researches have shown that when GST is removed, the saving of GST by the sellers, because they don't collect GST from consumers, so this is a saving, and that is not passed on to the consumer, because they claim the GST they pay on their purchases from IRD, and they do not get the GST from the sellers, from the consumers on their sales. But what happens that their sale cost indirectly increases, because they have to spend more time on updating their systems and making sure that products are correctly categorized, like what is GST-free and what is not GST-free. And all this takes a lot of their time and effort. So rather than spending their time on their business activities, they will be spending more time on these sort of things. And they have to make sure that they follow IRD rules correctly for categorization, what is GST-free and what is not GST-free. Otherwise, they will be penalized by IRD. And to avoid all that, they will be hiring the tax advisors. So that all will increase their cost. And who bears that cost? We, the consumers, bear that cost. And that is why it is not passed on to us, the consumers. Whatever is the age of the consumer, it doesn't matter. We all are consumers. Secondly, what I feel is that the Labour government is focusing too much on cost of living crisis. But other aspect of all this issue is that if you are removing GST, besides reducing the pressure of cost on the consumers, the other purpose is, which is implied, to encourage people to buy healthy food. Because by buying healthy food, it will remove the health or decrease the health problems. New Zealand already is third in the world in obesity index. And with the decrease of price of fruits and veggies, the question arises whether people are buying more fruits and veggies after this decrease or not. And researches have shown that when people save money, because demand of fruits and vegetables is inelastic, they do not spend more money to buy fruits and veggies they spend money on things which they like people may buy more liquor, or they may buy more meat or other things which may not be healthy. And as a consequence, in the long run, these health issues will increase rather than decrease, because saved money will be spent there. And we already have pressures on medical system of the country, so this will increase more pressures on the medical system. And ultimately, who bears that? We, the consumers, bear that. So that's why I think it is not a good idea by saying that we are decreasing the cost of living pressures, and that's why we are removing GST on fruits and veggies, because fruits and veggies are healthy items. That's the key purpose. But why fresh fruits and veggies only, or frozen? Then the question arises, I buy dried mushrooms. So why dried mushroom is not GST exempt? I buy canned beans. Why they are not GST exempt? So it will encourage shopkeepers to do all sort of fraudulent activities, wrong categorization as well. So due to these reasons, I think it is not a good idea. And to add on to this, I'll say Australia has food items, basic food items, exempt from GST for 22 years now. The consumption of fruits and veggies have not increased there. Health issues have not decreased there. So why are we doing this? I can't understand. And our GST system in the world is one of the best system. It is broad-based indirect consumption tax. And number of countries have followed this example of our GST system. So now we are following the system of other countries where a lot of cases and a lot of complexities are already there.
Do you think that there's any way that we could improve this policy? There have been some calls, for example, to extend getting rid of GST to all food. Do you think that this would be more effective?
Yes, that's what I have found in and suggested in my research. After looking at Australia, US, UK, that a program similar to food stamps and supplemental nutritional assistance program, it is called SNAP, and is used in US. If something similar to that we provide to our taxpayers who need low-income groups, who need more money to support, will be better, because what is done in USA, for example, they give electronic benefit transfer card like a debit card. So if we provide something like electronic benefit transfer card used in Australia, and this card could only be used by the individuals to buy fruits and veggies, only fruits and veggies. And this card should be accepted not only by supermarkets, but other local small fruits and veggies shops. Then people will use it only to buy fruits and veggies, and to ensure that the card is not misused. What I've suggested is that facial recognition or thumb scanning should be done to ensure that the person to whom the household to whom the card is issued, he or she and the authorized people of that household are using that card, so that card cannot be used to buy other items. Because that's the problem in US. They issue a debit card, but they do not ensure that who's using the card. So sometimes people pass on the car to someone else and get the money from that person. Or in UK, they use the voucher, because they give vouchers, and they use the vouchers at the shop to buy anything they like, and shopkeepers sell them whatever they want to buy, rather than ensuring that it is used to buy only the food items. And further to this, what I think is there should be some educational programs also to encourage people to buy healthy food, because only this card will not help. So educate food labeling and campaigns to educate youngers and kids on good heating and general food and nutrition programs, they will ensure the public is aware of the benefits of healthy eating. So it will reduce the pressures on the system as well, besides overcoming the increasing prices or cost of living crisis.
That was New Zealand Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff, Child Poverty Action Group's Alan Johnson, economist Brad Olson, and senior taxation lecturer at the Auckland University of Technology, Ranjana Gupta, talking about policy aimed at addressing the cost of living crisis.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
A survey conducted by the Public Health Communication Centre found that political parties tend to be short-sighted in their policy when it comes to dealing with catastrophic event risks. This poses the question of what Aotearoa needs to do to become more resilient and better prepared for threats like future pandemics, nuclear war, artificial intelligence, and the climate crisis. Millie spoke to co-director of the Public Health Communication Centre and professor in public health at the University of Otago, Nick Wilson, and started off the interview by asking about the findings of the study.
Well, the main finding was that there's a general lack of thinking around addressing global catastrophic risks and building resiliency for New Zealand amongst all the five political parties in Parliament that we surveyed. A slight exception was that they did generally talk about climate change, four of the five parties that we surveyed, particularly around building up resiliency to climate change impacts. But in terms of other catastrophic risks, only one party mentioned pandemics, and only one party mentioned cyber attacks. There were no mentions by any parties of the risk of nuclear war or of artificial intelligence getting out of control. This is despite many surveys of international experts suggesting these are important catastrophic risks that we need to be working on for prevention and mitigating. So, it's a very disappointing to sum up that, the political parties are very focused, we think, on short-term issues and are really ignoring these big-picture issues that really, some of the biggest threats to human survival and to civilization survival.
Why do you think they haven't focused on the long term?
Well, I think if you look at the policies overall of the parties, they're very focused on short term issues, fixing potholes and roads and dealing with various crises in the health system. And this is a problem when you have governments that only run for 3 years, they have to, they've only got a year or so of passing policies before they're back into election mode. So having a longer term, maybe a five-year term would help. But also looking at what other countries are doing around building parts of the government system into being forced to look at long-term issues. And This has started to happen in parts of the New Zealand government system with long-term briefings being required. But the best approach is to actually have part of the government dedicated to looking at long-term issues, to thinking about future generations and these big picture risks. And, you know, some other countries have developed such agencies, or they've had things like a parliamentary commissioner for the future, or to deal with big risks. So New Zealand's behind some other countries in this area, and we are in this constant problem of just dealing with short-term crises.
Can you globally think of any examples of governments that have introduced policy that creates a strong framework around potential catastrophic risks?
Yes, we actually, the United States last year passed a Global Catastrophic Risk Management Act that requires all government agencies to look at the big catastrophic risks and consider how to manage them. So that would be quite a good model. And other countries, like, you know, in Wales, for example, they've had a commissioner looking at future, for, you know, protecting future generations. So there's some of those type of models. But even New Zealand itself, back in the 1980s, had a commission for the future, which the Muldoon government scrapped, unfortunately. So, you know, there are these models for how to address these risks, and we really need to look at them, because you know there's just increasing concern about future pandemics and artificial intelligence, for example.
Would you like to see a ministry or a commission into future planning be made?
Yes, we have actually written a paper about having a parliamentary commissioner for extreme risks. So that's one approach. But yeah, having a dedicated agency, maybe part of the emergency management system that looks at catastrophic risks. At the moment, the emergency management system in New Zealand just looks at sort of more common hazards like floods and earthquakes and so on. It really needs to take a more expansive view, given you know, we've just had the dramatic impact of a COVID-19 pandemic, but future pandemics could be far worse with bioengineered pathogens that may be more likely with developments in both biotechnology and artificial intelligence.
Are you hoping that the findings of this survey lead political parties in Aotearoa to seek advice where necessary and make plans surrounding long-term risks?
We hope so, and definitely when after the election and there's a new government, we'll be encouraging that government to take a fresh look at these issues and hopefully build in systems so that this is no longer such a neglected area of government thinking.
Do you believe that catastrophic risks are more pressing than ever currently?
Absolutely. I think international experts on catastrophic risk are increasingly concerned. So there's not only developments with biotechnology and artificial intelligence that increase the risk of engineered pandemics, but also the risk of artificial intelligence getting out of control. They're increasingly areas of concern, but also the risk of nuclear war, with the deterioration in relationships between major countries, the war in Ukraine. Most countries with nuclear weapons arsenals are expanding those arsenals or else upgrading and modernising them in various ways, which may all increase the risk of nuclear war. So, yeah, these are concerns that really should be, you know, policymakers should really be engaging with them. I mean, they're starting to engage with climate change, but really they're ignoring all these other big catastrophic risks.
So ultimately, the advice for the New Zealand government is to, sooner rather than later, look at the global models and employ them in terms of long-term thinking and catastrophic risk.
Yes, and these preparations may have spin-off benefits for better managing the more day-to-day problems like severe storms and floods and building resiliency in other ways. So we really need to get the win-wins between building resiliency to catastrophic risk and building resiliency to day-to-day risks around more severe weather events and so on. So some of these actions that we're suggesting for dealing with these big risks may be very worthwhile for lots of reasons and increase New Zealand's resiliency over a wide range of domains.
That was University of Otago Professor Nick Wilson talking to Millie about New Zealand political parties and their approach to long-term and catastrophic risks.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Last week, the University of Auckland held its annual three-minute thesis competition. I spoke with the winner of the competition and University of Auckland biologist, Cam Hofbleck, about her research into the unique gut microbiome of Tuatara and its implications for the species' future against the context of a changing climate. Your research focused on the Tuatara population of Stephens Island, where about 90% of all Tuatara in New Zealand live. What drew you to study a Tonga native species of Aotearoa?
So I'm from the US, and I've always been really interested in conservation, but in the States, it's a bit of a harder sell to get people behind it. So when I came here in 2020, I basically only knew that Aotearoa was very beautiful and had all this great wildlife, but I didn't know the specifics. And then when I came here, I started working with takahe, which are amazing birds. And I really fell in love with the kiwi and the kakapo and all of the special birds in New Zealand. It really turned me into a birder, but I didn't know much about Tuatara. So when I came back, my advisor asked if I wanted to work with them, so I started looking into them a bit more. And they're so special. But I think that cultural connection really draws me in a lot more here than in the States. Like, the people really care about protecting these animals. And then the connection to the iwi as well as the Tonga species, just the work that's already gone into conserving them, is really impressive here.
What makes Tuatara so sensitive to a changing climate?
So they're actually a little more protected than some reptile species. So as cold-blooded species, reptiles don't have a way to cool down. They're completely dependent on the air temperature, essentially. So most reptiles actually prefer it as it gets warmer because they can move around more. I don't know if you've ever seen those little tiny skinks when it's cold and they're just like, can't move at all because it's so cold. But when it warms up, they can move around a bit more. But Tuatara are cold adapted, so they used to live all throughout Aotearoa, all the way down in the far south of the South Island. So super big range. And they're so cold adapted that when I'm holding them in my hand, I have to be concerned about my body temperature affecting them. So they're definitely very easily impacted by the heat. They start not being able to function as well, and they start drying out, which is really bad for them. But luckily for Tuatara, they're burrowing reptiles, so they live underground, and most of the day they stay in their burrow where they're protected from temperature spikes, and they also leave their eggs underground. So I don't know if you've heard about sea turtles. They're having a problem where more and more of the eggs are female because the temperature determines the sex of the eggs. So Tuatara is actually opposite, so more and more males will become male, but since their eggs are underground, they're less impacted by those temperature spikes.
Your thesis pitch, which won you the three-minute thesis pitch competition, focused on the microbiome of the Tuatara. What is a microbiome, and how does the Tuatara's microbiome separate it from other species?
Great question. So everything has a microbiome. It's just the collection of microorganisms, so bacteria, fungi, viruses that live on or inside of an animal, or even they form biofilms as well, just these random communities of bacteria. But I look at them inside hosts. So I'm looking at the bacteria specifically that live inside the gut of the Tuatara. So Tuatara, we've never looked at their gut bacteria before. There's been research into what viruses they have and then into a specific bacteria, Salmonella, that almost all reptiles have. So if you handle any skinks, you should wash your hands because they probably have Salmonella. But Tuatara have never been found with Salmonella, which means they're really weird. And we already know they're really weird evolutionarily. They have no living relatives. They're the only species in their order. So we basically have no idea what their microbiome looks like. And from my preliminary work, it looks really weird, like a lot of unidentified bacteria, which is really exciting.
Finally, what does your research mean for the conservation of Tuatara in the midst of an escalating climate crisis?
I think with all species, there's kind of the basics of as the temperature warms, some of those mammalian predators are going to be able to get into new places. So rats and stoats are really good at capitalizing on, oh, now the temperature is warmer, so I'm going to go into these new areas that I haven't been in before. And then also with sea level rise, of course, we'll start losing some of the ground on the islands that are really important for Tuatara conservation and lots of other species. But the main one is just that temperature problem. So Tuatara living in the north of Aotearoa are already at kind of the thermal tolerance up here. So we want to be aware of if it continues getting hotter, which of course it will under climate change, we want to know how that's going to impact Tuatara. A lot of times that can make you more vulnerable to infection. So if your gut community changes, like if, you know, you or I take antibiotics, then sometimes people can get sick after that because you've destabilized that gut community. So we know that as temperatures rise in other species, it can make them more vulnerable to infection and make them less effective at digesting and things like that. So we want to be aware of that for Tuatara and see if we can supplement their diet, if that would help, or if we don't need to worry about that and they're going to be fine.
That was University of Auckland biologist Cam Hofbleck talking about her research into Tuatara.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tine wiki ni te mihi ki a koutou katoa mai ki o mo tine ra. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, New Zealand Union of Students Associations National President Alan Dixon, New Zealand Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff, Child Poverty Action Group's Alan Johnson, economist Brad Olson, Senior Taxation Lecturer at AUT Ranjana Gupta, Co-Director of the Public Health Communications Centre and Professor in Public Health at the University of Otago Nick Wilson, and University of Auckland biologist Cam Hofbleck. Nira hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM.
Don't try.
questions that we're asking, but we'll never know.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.